This is the fourth day of this January 2010 Rohatz session. I don't know if this is a wise decision to give my giving Teisho today with my cold, but I may keep it short. We left off yesterday. Oh yes, we're resuming reading from the chronological biography of Zen Master Hakuin, and this is from a book called Hakuin's Precious Mirror Cave, translated and edited by Norman Waddell. I think somewhere in the book it says that he spent years translating this, maybe this and the other entries in the book. We left off yesterday with him at age 28. Here's just a little thing that I skipped over yesterday. When he wasn't looking after Sokudo, that was one of his earlier teachers, he was ill. When he wasn't looking after Sokudo, he spent all his spare time doing zazen, never sitting for less than 8 sticks of incense a night. We don't know how long it takes to burn a stick of incense in those days, but it would be at least half an hour, if not an hour. Here we have the two lengths. One is half an hour or so, and the other is an hour. We read yesterday about him wading across a stream that was flooded, swollen by floodwaters and by rain, and falling in, having another awakening and roaring with laughter. And then he found a teacher by the name of Eggoku. He introduced himself and said, "I'm confident I have grasped the essentials of the way, but in my everyday life I'm still unable to reach the realm of great peace and tranquility, great emancipation. Please tell me what to do." And this master said, "A person in your situation should live in the mountains. Remain until you wither away together with the plants and trees." And he took him to heart, as we'll hear just a little later, when he finds his own mountain hermitage. I'm skipping again, skipping around here. One night the master sat on into the early hours of the morning. In the gathering light, he heard the sound of snow falling from the trees outside the room. Suddenly, he penetrated the koan. A woman comes out of samadhi. This is a koan in the Mumunkan. Age 29, he left one temple he had been staying at, and stayed and returned to another one, stayed until winter and took part in the Rohatsu training session. One day, as he was doing kinhin, everything heretofore attained suddenly fell away, and he roamed totally free and unrestricted beyond the mundane world. I wanted to read this bit because I think too many people don't recognize the potential for practice during kinhin. It is a chance to move your legs, relieve your legs from all the sitting, but it's much more than that. It's an opportunity to practice Zazen in motion. And as we hear here from about Hakuin, there's every opportunity to have the mind open during Kinin. Sometimes wonder how many people leave the Zendo during Kinin just because they're restless, they want to wander around a little bit and sip a little water and do this or that. But the posture that we use in Kinin, this posture with the hands held at the chest, is such a strong posture for maintaining one's concentration between rounds that it's really a valuable opportunity. That's one thing I love about the Zendo, is that since we do it on the perimeter of the Zendo, we don't see all that many other people as we used to in Rochester, when we would snake through the Zendo, through the middle of the Zendo. And here we have more, we're more secluded during Kinin and can really take advantage of that by going deeper. The age of 30, he went off to seek a remote spot away from the world where he could devote himself single-handedly to the cultivation of the way. He resolved to continue his quest until he achieved his goal, vowing not to stop even if it cost him his life. He went east. On the way, a man told him of a mountain called Iwataki, which was, quote, cut off on all sides from worldly intrusion. There's nothing there but a tiny hut, but you couldn't ask for a better place to devote yourself quietly to Zazen. Well, that's all Hakuin needed to hear. He headed for Iwataki. Sounds like he did enormous amount of wandering on pilgrimages through Japan. Well, he found his way there and secluded himself. There was a hut there. Here's a little glimpse into his daily life. Every day the master chanted sutras and dharanis while beating a small mokugyo, endeavoring to deepen his concentration and promote the working of prajna wisdom. If we could see chanting as holding out that possibility, that promise, we would find it more rewarding, maybe even than we already do. It's a way to deepen concentration and promote the working of prajna wisdom. The prajna wisdom part would be the way in which we absorb these truths in the chants that we do. They seep in at a deep level when we're chanting no-mindedly, when we're free of thoughts. It's not like we're trying to learn these things, but they find their way into the recesses of the mind. There's a Zen Center member from many, many years ago who, after a 7-day sesshin, woke up in the middle of the night, that last night after sesshin ended, and the Prajnaparamita came into his mind in a very deep way. He was only half awake, but he found himself reflecting, going through this Prajnaparamita, and he had a Kensho. One night he heard in the sky above him strains of wonderful celestial music. As he listened, the sounds grew ever more pleasing to his ears. But he simply paid them no heed and focused on contemplating the principle that all forms and appearances are false and empty. The sounds continued for 6 or 7 nights in succession until suddenly, in the midst of samadhi, he realized they were only figments of his own mind. Well, this is, of course, the standard advice about how to deal with even pleasant or inspiring makyo visions, is to not get involved with them. It's all figments of our own mind. Living amid the deep mountain stillness, cut off from intrusions of external sound, with his mind perfectly tranquil and sense of hearing quiet and undisturbed, he found the least exertion of ki energy would immediately produce a faint ringing inside his ears. Even the slightest thought was enough to sustain the noise, which resonated deep inside his ears and gave rise to various other sounds. Later, the master told his monks, "Those who engage in zazen should just be aware that such things will occur. If you live deep in the mountains, practicing by yourself, you will experience maras, seductions in many forms. They can easily distract you from your training." This is one of the advantages of sitting with others in sesshin with a teacher, is to be able to work through makyo and other obstructions and be guided on doing that. When you're off isolated in the middle of nowhere, it's more of a challenge to just let go of these things. He tells a story of sitting doing zazen in his hut when he received a visitation that he refers to as a goblin storming in, huge figure. As he was contemplating these thoughts, all obstructions and impediments, physical and mental, suddenly vanished, and he experienced a state of absolute fearlessness. He later told people, "From that time on, it was the same to me whether things went smoothly or not. Now, even in the presence of those of exalted rank, I am as easy and relaxed as I am in my own sleeping quarters. Even when I am immersed in the noise and myriad appearances of the world, it is as though I am alone by myself meditating in the training hall." The master continued to practice, this is age 31, to practice arduously in the hut on Mount Iwataki. A certain layman arranged for his son to bring food to the master, but the master recalled those of the past who, in pursuing the way, had either abstained from food or else partaken of very little. Their food and clothing were always of the poorest kind. One priest sat for 100 days, subsisting on half of a dried persimmon twice a day. Others boiled bracken and baked wild yams to sustain their bodies and nourish their ki energy. He thought, "Who am I to idly consume these precious offerings?" From then on, he set himself a daily ration of half a handful of rice. And then we're told that his father, now bedridden with illness, was deeply concerned about the fate of the family temple, Shoinji. Our Shoinji was founded by Uncle Daizui, he said. The two of us put a great deal of time and work into building it up. Now it is furnished with all the requisite halls and structures. It is even blessed with splendid tall trees. But unless we take steps now to protect the temple, it will before long become a field for the foxes and rabbits. My son Ekaku still hasn't returned. Oh, what are we to do? And then an old family servant offered to go track him down, get him to come back. So I'm just summarizing here. He took some travel money, the servant, and set out at once. He scoured each of the provinces he passed through, one after another. Finally, he heard talk of a solitary monk who was living on Mount Iwataki, engaged in a severe regimen of religious practice. So he went up the mountain and sought Hakuin out. The master could scarcely believe his eyes. Shichibei, what are you doing here? He asked in astonishment. You can just pick the image that comes to your mind of this guy scrambling up the mountain with Hakuin sitting there in samadhi in the middle of nowhere. And then the servant said, Reverend priest, while you conceal yourself here like this, enjoying your spiritual exercises. Poor Hakuin. Okay. Shoinji is without a priest, not to mention your father, who is very ill. No one can say how much longer he has left. Don't you think you have an obligation to return home and repay some of the debt you owe him? And so Hakuin conceded that he had this filial duty to fulfill. He went home. His father was overjoyed to see him. And he was installed as the resident priest at Shoinji. At the time, Shoinji was in an almost indescribable state of disrepair. And now, in this description, you can hear Hakuin's writing. At night, the stars shone through the roofs. The tokonoma was sodden with rain and dew. It was kind of a veranda. It was necessary for the master to wear a sedge hat as he moved about the temple attending to his duties. He had to wear wooden sandals when he was in the main hall to conduct memorial ceremonies. This would be just completely unheard of to wear footwear in the temple, especially for memorial ceremonies. The assets of the temple had passed into the hands of creditors. Ceremonial equipment and other temple furnishings had all been pawned. There was an old servant who gathered wood for fuel, collected vegetables, and managed to produce two meals morning and night. Another monk who showed up was made an attendant of the master and was able to help supply the kitchen through daily begging rounds. One day, the master, taking a look at the monk's haggard face, exclaimed dolefully, "Oh, my, look what's happened to you from staying and helping me. The halls haven't any door panels in them. We can't use the room lamps. About the only assets around here worth noting are the moonlight and the sound of the wind. I have no way whatever of making things easier even for a single monk like you." To show his gratitude, he gave the monk some personal instruction using Dawi's letters as a text. As he looked back over the time he had spent in the mountains of Iwataki, he was moved to compose a verse. Good times, hard times too, both fade far away. So happy am I now, I'll never want to seek another mountain again. So this was age 32. That year, Myoshinji, the headquarters temple in Kyoto, awarded him the rank of first monk, so it was now official. Myoshinji is one of the largest and most venerable temple complexes in Japan. It's in Kyoto, and he was officially ensconced there. But what's interesting is that Hakuin never received any kind of sanctioning to teach, any Dharma transmission while he was alive. And he never received, certainly from one of his many teachers. And at age 35, he accepted his first student. I'm skipping through. There are a lot of little bits here that we don't have time to read. Oh, here's one. Age 38, the quality of the provisions in the temple larder grew steadily worse. The monks made the rounds of nearby shops begging for shoyu, that's soy sauce, that had gone rancid and was about to be thrown out. Once at mealtime, the temple cook served some cold soup. The surface was alive with wriggling maggots. "Pay more attention to your work," scolded Hakuin. "Maggots breed in rancid shoyu," said the cook. "I couldn't bring myself to kill them, so I just poured it all into the stock and made the soup without heating it." You mean that's all there is?" asked the master with a laugh. "We never have extra provisions," said the cook. "We beg what others are about to discard and use it for the morning and evening meals. Why don't we set the soup aside and wait until the maggots have all hatched? Then we can ladle them out." Oh, yeah. There are lots of little anecdotes, like not so many that funny, but or pathetic. Skipping to age 40, Hakuin had resided at Shoenji now for 10 years. During that time, he had given himself single-mindedly to his practice and had endured great difficulty and privation without ever deviating from a spare, simple way of life. He followed no fixed schedule for chanting or other rituals. When darkness fell, he would climb inside an old palanquin. Palanquin is one of these things that you raise up the seated person like a royal person, and it has two poles, and there are four people who carry it on their shoulders. So what it was doing there, who knows? But he would climb inside an old palanquin and seat himself on a thick cushion he placed on the floorboard. The young boys studying at Shoenji would then come, wrap a futon around the master's body, and cinch him tightly into this position with a rope. There he would remain without moving, looking just like a painting of Bodhidharma, until the following day when the boys would come and untie him so he could relieve his bowels and take some food. The same routine was repeated every night. Neither did he neglect the words and sayings of the Buddhas and patriarchs. They never left his side. He used them to verify the meaning of the ancient worthy's injunction, quote, to illuminate the old teachings with the mind, to illuminate the mind with the old teachings. This is the best use, of course, of the sutras and the shastras. Shastras are the commentaries by former masters about the sutras, to use them to check one's understanding and bring them to life. He had a room built 100 paces or so behind the abbot's quarters where he could devote himself quietly to Zazen, free from all outside cares. Once he entered the room, no one except the monks permitted to receive Doksan dared to approach him. And then the biography says, he observed this same rigor and scrupulousness throughout his residence at Shōinji. You can see why Hakuin is revered as something of a near deity in Japan, especially in the Rinzai school. And his counterpart in the Soto school is Dogen. Very, very, very different styles of teaching, very different personalities. Age 41, autumn. Hakuin hung up the schedule for sutra chanting on the announcement board. So this is some kind of a turning point to actually have a schedule. He read the Lotus Sutra. One night as he was reading in the chapter on parables, that was the chapter where earlier he had just closed the book because he couldn't relate to it. As he was reading in the chapter on parables, a cricket began shrilling at the foundation stones of the temple. The instant the sound reached his ears, the deep principle of the Lotus Sutra was suddenly his. The doubts and uncertainties that had arisen at the beginning of his religious quest and remained with him all this time now suddenly dissolved and ceased to exist. He realized the understanding he had gained in all his many satoris had been greatly mistaken. He could see with perfect clarity the reason for the Lotus's reputation as the king of sutras. He let out an involuntary shout and began weeping uncontrollably. He was able to see for the first time the enlightened words and deeds that had marked Shōjū's everyday life, and to understand that when the world-honored one spoke, his tongue lacked all sinew and muscle and moved with perfect freedom. From this moment on, Hakuin lived in a state of great emancipation. Now I'm again skipping through other assorted little anecdotes and minor things. At age 54, the monks at Shōinji got together and decided to make preparations for a lecture meeting on a text called The Record of Shu Tong. I'm not familiar with that name. At first, the master was strongly opposed to the idea, but the monks went ahead with the work anyway. As he watched how eagerly and diligently they strove toward their goal and realized the strength of their commitment, his opposition softened. Then he went away on a trip for a while. The monks made good use of his absence, repairing the old temple roofs. They sank a new well shaft. They made rounds the Takahatsu to lay in a store of beans and wheat and begged vegetables to stock the kitchen. All the monks worked ceaselessly and selflessly, mending gaps and cracks in the walls and making other repairs where they were needed. Meanwhile, a couple of names here, his monks, staked off an area outside the temple and rehearsed the ceremonies for the upcoming meeting so they would be ready to advise the master as to the correct procedures to follow. So our practice here of rehearsing ceremonies goes back a long way. Age 56, when a monk from Kyushu, one of the islands of Japan, one of the larger islands, when a monk from Kyushu arrived and performed his greeting, the master said, "I heard you were back. They say you've been rambling extensively beyond the barrier. What do you have to show for it?" "You didn't hear?" said the monk. "I've trained with a number of eminent teachers. My awakening came as I was working on pacifying the mind, the koan barrier raised by the second patriarch." This is also in the Mumonkan, Bodhidharma and Mind Pacifying is the title we give it. "I no longer have any doubts whatever. Everything is splendid. I'm vim and vigor from head to foot. Great peace and happiness." These are in quotation marks. "Great emancipation. Fire is hot. Water is cool. What more is there to do?" Can you see what he's heading for disaster? What more to seek? "I have no ambition to lecture on the Zen records or to amuse myself writing verses as you do." Fools rush in where angels fear to tread. But already Hakuin now in his late 50s is apparently mellowed some, so he doesn't, lop off his head. Instead, he says, "What about the second patriarch's pacification of mind?" Again, referring to that same koan in the Mumonkan. "As long as you seek mind, it's ungettable," said the monk. This is a simple, ordinary understanding of the koan. "As long as you seek mind, it's ungettable." And then Hakuin said, "Scratching yourself behind the ear, your hand touches a Buddha's head. It can't be anyone but you. When will you be able to stop bending your left elbow and touching a dog's head?" said the master. I don't know what in the world that means. It's, so many of these things in the texts and especially in the koans are cultural references that we wouldn't know without learning them. The monk sat dumbfounded. And then Hakuin continued. "Fa Yan said, a water buffalo comes in through the window. Head, horns, four hooves all make it through. Why doesn't the tail too?" "What does that mean?" asked the master. This is number 38 in the Mumonkan. The monk sat dumbfounded. "A moment ago," now this is back to Hakuin, "a moment ago you told me fire is hot and water is cool. But one of the ancients also said, willows are not green, flowers are not red." "Look!" The monk sat dumbfounded. A senior monk came returned from somewhere to resume his training. The master asked, "Where do you come from when you're born? Where do you go when you die?" The monk raised a finger. "You aren't there yet," said the master. "Say something else." And then the monk said, "Where do you come from when you're born? Where do you go when you die?" And then the master wrote a verse confirming the monk's realization. Then it wasn't until Hakuin was 58 that his biographer and successor, Tore, arrived and began training with him. He was appointed as a special unassigned attendant. A monk who was in residence temporarily there asked him, "It's said that with a seasoned Zen teacher, quote, there's no pecking in and no pecking out. Pecking in and pecking out are equally mistaken. What principle does that elucidate?" This is an old cherished metaphor for the work between teacher and student. The chick in the egg pecks, and the hen taps. And then Hakuin said, "The chick inside the egg wants to peck, but doesn't. So the mother hen pecks," the master replied. "It's important to be aware when you failed to respond to a student satisfactorily." The monk performed a bow. "Peck," said the master. The monk gave a loud shout. "Awakened," said the master. Here's an interesting little note. When he was 59, in the spring, he conducted belated ceremonies in observance of Bodhidharma's death day, which is held in October here too, and Shakyamuni's enlightenment, held in the 12th month. So he held these ceremonies belatedly because they had not been observed at Shoinji the previous year. He gave a talk where he instructed students with a story of a starving man at a tea shop. I'm going to read this. It's a footnote. The story is about the son of a wealthy Edo family. This is a ruling family at the time in Japan. A wealthy Edo family who was disowned for his profligate ways and thrown out of the family house. Rejected by his friends, without a cent to his name, and dressed in a ragged robe, he started along the Tokaido, that's a main road, in the direction of Kyoto. Ravenously hungry, when he saw a tea shop selling fried buns, he ordered 20 or 30 of them, gobbled them up, and then ran off without paying. Townspeople soon caught up with him, and when they found he had no money, they gave him a severe beating. He tearfully related his life story to the young men surrounding him, telling them he had been without food for 3 days and had suddenly decided to eat and run, knowing he would probably be caught and beaten to death. After hearing the story, the young man left him where he was, quote, crying in the dust. Describing the difficulties the man had undergone in order to prolong his life, Hakuin compares them with the adversities that young monks must undergo in their search for enlightenment, pointing out that both of them endure suffering, but that the end result is as different as the moon is from a turtle. So if you're going to go without food, Hakuin is saying, then use that hunger to drive you deeper into your practice. So when Hakuin was 61, he offered Dharma transmission to Toray. That's only 3 years after Toray came to him. That's a little odd, a little brief. And a letter arrived from Toray, who was living elsewhere, informing Hakuin of his acceptance of the Dharma transmission. When the master expressed a desire to make his sanction of Toray public, several of his senior disciples tried to dissuade him. If you can't bring yourself to believe, now this is Hakuin, if you can't bring yourself to believe in the man from reading what he writes, how are you going to understand what is written in the books about the ancient Zen masters? None of those present dared make a reply. I just throw that out there, that anecdote, without comment. When he was 62, a man came to see him. The man said, I enjoy visiting Buddhist teachers and receiving instructions from them, but as a result of those visits, I seem to have contracted an intractable sickness. What sickness would that be? Asked the master. Well, I first went to a Zen teacher. He had me investigate my mind nature. Next, I went to a precepts teacher, that's Vinaya, to inquire into the secrets of the esoteric school. He introduced me to the essentials of that tradition. I started having doubts about the two teachings. Now, when I engage in the contemplation on the letter A, that's a practice of the esoteric school, Tendai school, I think, my mind immediately fills with terrifying visions of hell. If I attempt to suppress them using the principle of the mind nature, the two standpoints clash and cause me considerable distress. When I sleep, I'm plagued by bad dreams. When I'm awake, my mind is in constant turmoil. And then Hakuin said, why don't you find out who it is that fears hell so much? And the man said, but my trouble is, I'm stuck in a state of emptiness. The master uttered a series of loud shouts. Half-baked wretch, he said. A samurai is supposed to be totally devoted to his master, no hesitating in the face of fire or other dangers. He entrusts his life to the sword and spear without so much as stopping to scratch an itch or blink an eye. How could a samurai fear emptiness? Go down into the evil paths right now. Take a good close look at all the different hells you see while you're there. The man said, is it proper for a Buddhist teacher to tell a student to enter the realm of hell? The master laughed. I've been there myself many times, seen all 84,000 hells. I haven't missed a single one. Overjoyed, the man prostrated himself before the master, Hakuin. Our time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four vows.